Chapter 35. The Christ-like Life of Lahiri Mahashai. Thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. In these words to John the Baptist, and in asking John to baptize him, Jesus was acknowledging the divine rights of his Guru. From a reverent study of the Bible from an Oriental viewpoint, and from intuitional perception, I am convinced that John the Baptist was, in past lives, the Guru of Christ. Numerous passages in the Bible imply that John and Jesus, in their last incarnations, were, respectively, Elijah and his disciple Elisha. These are the spellings in the Old Testament. The Greek translators spelled the names as Elias and Eliseus. They reappear in the New Testament in these changed forms. The very end of the Old Testament is a prediction of the reincarnation of Elijah and Elisha. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Thus John, Elijah, sent before the coming of the Lord, was born slightly earlier to serve as a herald for Christ. An angel appeared to Zacharias the father to testify that his coming son, John, would be none other than Elijah, Elias. But the angel said unto him, Fear not, Zacharias, for thy prayer is heard, and thy wife, Elizabeth, shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name John. And many of the children of Israel shall he turn to the Lord their God. And he shall go before him in the spirit and the power of Elias, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Jesus twice unequivocally identified Elijah, Elias, as John. Elias is come already, and they knew him not. Then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. Again Christ says, For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if ye will receive it, this is Elias, which was for to come. When John denied that he was Elias, Elijah, he meant that in the humble garb of John he came no longer in the outward elevation of Elijah the great guru. In his former incarnation, he had given the mantle of his glory and his spiritual wealth to his disciple Elisha. And Elisha said, I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. And he said, Thou hast asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I am taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee. And he took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him. The roles became reversed, because Elijah John was no longer needed to be the ostensible guru of Elisha Jesus, now divinely perfected. When Christ was transfigured on the mountain, it was his guru Elias with Moses that he saw. In his hour of extremity on the cross, Jesus cried out, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, This man calleth for Elias. Let us see whether Elias will come to save him. The timeless bond of guru and disciple that existed between John and Jesus was present also for Babaji and Lahiri Mahashai. With tender solicitude, the deathless guru swam the abysmal waters that swelled between two lives of his chela, and guided the successive steps taken by the child and then by the man, Lahiri Mahashai. It was not until the disciple had reached his 33rd year that Babaji deemed the time ripe for re-establishing openly the never-severed link. After the brief meeting near Raniket, the selfless guru did not keep the beloved disciple by his side, but released Lahiri Mahashai for an outward world mission. My son, I shall come whenever you need me. What mortal lover can fulfill the infinite implications of such a promise? Unknown to society in general, A great spiritual renaissance started in 1861 in a remote corner of Benares. As the fragrance of flowers cannot be suppressed, so Lahiri Mahashai, quietly living as an ideal householder, could not hide his innate glory. Devotee bees from every part of India began to seek the divine nectar of the liberated master. The English office superintendent was one of the first to notice a strange, transcendental change in his employee, whom he affectionately called Ecstatic Babu. "Sir, you seem sad. What is the trouble?" The Lahiri Mahashai made this sympathetic inquiry one morning to his employer. "My wife in England is critically ill. I am torn by anxiety." "I shall get you some word about her." The Lahiri Mahashai left the room and sat for a short time in a secluded spot. On his return, he smiled consolingly. "Your wife is improving. She is now writing you a letter." The omniscient yogi quoted some parts of the missive. "Ecstatic Babu, I already know that you are no ordinary man, yet I am unable to believe that, at will, you can banish time and space." The promised letter finally arrived. The astounded superintendent found that it contained not only the good news of his wife's recovery, but also the same phrases that weeks earlier the great master had uttered. The wife came to India some months later. Meeting Lahiri Mahashai, she gazed at him reverently. "Sir," she said, "it was your form, hallowed in glorious light, that I beheld months ago by my sickbed in London. At that moment I was completely healed. Soon after, I was able to undertake the long ocean voyage to India." Day after day, the sublime guru initiated one or two devotees into Kriya Yoga. In addition to these spiritual duties, and to the responsibilities of his business and family life, the great master took an enthusiastic interest in education. He organized many study groups and played an active part in the growth of a large high school in the Bengali Tola section of Benares. At weekly meetings, which came to be called his Gita Assembly, the guru expounded the scriptures to many eager truth-seekers. By these manifold activities, Lahiri Mahashai sought to answer the common challenge. After performing one's business and social duties, where is the time for devotional meditation? The harmoniously balanced life of the great householder guru became the inspiration of thousands of men and women. Earning only a modest salary, thrifty, unostentatious, accessible to all, the master carried on naturally and happily in the path of disciplined worldly life. Though ensconced in the seat of the Supreme One, Lahiri Mahashai showed reverence to all men, irrespective of their differing merits. When his devotees saluted him, he bowed in turn to them. With a childlike humility, the master often touched the feet of others, but seldom allowed them to pay him similar honour, even though such obeisance towards the guru is an ancient oriental custom. A significant feature of Lahiri Mahashai's life was his gift of Kriya initiations to those of every faith. Not Hindus only, but Muslims and Christians were among his foremost disciples. Monists and dualists, those of various faiths, or of no established faith, were impartially received and instructed by the universal guru. One of his highly advanced chelas was Abdul Ghaffar Khan, a Muslim. Lahiri Mahashai, belonging himself to the highest or Brahmin caste, made courageous efforts to dissolve the rigid caste bigotry of his time. Those from every walk of life found shelter under the master's omnipresent wings. Like all other God-inspired prophets, Lahiri Mahashai gave new hope to the outcasts and the downtrodden of society. "Remember that you belong to no one, and that no one belongs to you. Reflect that some day you will suddenly have to leave everything in this world. So make the acquaintance of God now," the great guru told his disciples. "Prepare yourself for the coming astral journey of death by riding daily in a balloon of divine perception. Through delusion, you are perceiving yourself as a bundle of flesh and bones, which at best is a nest of troubles. Meditate unceasingly, that you quickly behold yourself as the infinite essence, free from every form of misery. Cease being a prisoner of the body. Using the secret key of Kriya, learn to escape into spirit. The Master encouraged his various disciples to adhere to the good traditional discipline of their own faiths. Stressing the all-inclusive nature of Kriya Yoga as a practical technique of liberation, Lahiri Mahashai then gave his chelas liberty to express their lives in conformance with environment and upbringing. A Muslim should perform his namaj worship 5 times daily, the master pointed out. Several times daily, a Hindu should sit in meditation. A Christian should go down on his knees several times daily, praying to God and then reading the Bible. With wise discernment, the Guru guided his followers into the paths of bhakti, devotion, karma, action, jnana, wisdom, or raja, royal or complete, yoga. According to each man's natural tendencies, the master, who was slow to give his permission to devotees wishing to enter the formal path of monkhood, always cautioned them first to reflect well on the austerities of the monastic life. The great guru taught his disciples to avoid theoretical discussion of the scriptures. He only is wise who devotes himself to realizing, not reading only, the ancient revelations, he said. Solve all your problems through meditation. Exchange unprofitable speculations for actual God communion. Clear your mind of dogmatic theological debris. Let in the fresh healing waters of direct perception. Attune yourself to the active inner guidance. The divine voice has the answer to every dilemma of life. Though man's ingenuity for getting himself into trouble appears to be endless, the infinite succor is no less resourceful. The Master's omnipresence was demonstrated one day before a group of disciples who were listening to his exposition on the Bhagavad Gita. As he was explaining the meaning of Kutastha Chaitanya, or the Christ consciousness in all vibratory creation, Lahiri Mahashai suddenly gasped and cried out, "I am drowning in the bodies of many souls off the coast of Japan." The next morning, the chelas read a cabled newspaper account of the deaths of a number of persons whose ship had foundered the preceding day near Japan. Many distant disciples of Lahiri Mahashai were aware of his enfolding presence. "I am ever with those who practice Kriya," he would say consolingly to chelas who could not remain near him. "I will guide you to the cosmic home through your ever-enlarging spiritual perceptions." Sri Bhupendra Nath Sanyal, an eminent disciple of the great guru, stated that as a youth in 1892, unable to go to Benares, he prayed to the master for spiritual instruction. Lahiri Mahashai appeared before Bhupendra in a dream and gave him Diksha, initiation. Later, the boy went to Benares and asked the guru for Diksha. "I have already initiated you in a dream," Lahiri Mahashai replied. If a disciple neglected any of his worldly obligations, the master would gently correct and discipline him. Lahiri Mahashai's words were mild and healing, even when he was forced to speak openly of a chela's faults, Sri Yukteswar once told me. He added, ruefully, "No disciple ever fled from our master's barbs." I could not help laughing, but I truthfully assured my guru that, sharp or not, his every word was music to my ears. Lahiri Mahashai carefully graded Kriya into 4 progressive initiations. He bestowed the 3 higher techniques only after a devotee had manifested definite spiritual progress. One day, a certain chela, convinced that his worth was not being duly evaluated, gave voice to his discontent. Master, he said, surely I am ready now for the second initiation. At this moment, the door opened to admit a humble disciple, Brinda Bhagat. He was a Benares postman. Brinda, sit by me here. The great guru smiled at him affectionately. Tell me, are you ready for the second kriya? The little postman folded his hands supplicatingly. Gurudeva, he said in alarm, no more initiations, please. How can I assimilate any higher teachings? I have come today to ask your blessings, because the first kriya has filled me with such divine intoxication that I cannot deliver the letters. Already, Brinda swims in the sea of spirit. At these words from Lahiri Mahashai, the other disciple hung his head. Master, he said, I see, I have been a poor workman, finding fault with my tools. The lowly postman, who was uneducated, later developed his insight through kriya to such an extent that scholars occasionally sought his interpretation on involved scriptural points. Innocent alike of sin and syntax, little Brinda won renown in the domain of learned pundits. Besides the numerous Benares disciples of Lahiri Mahashai, hundreds came to him from distant parts of India. He himself travelled to Bengal on several occasions, visiting at the homes of the fathers-in-law of his two sons. Thus, blessed by his presence, Bengal became honeycombed with small kriya groups. Particularly in the districts of Krishnanagar and Bishnupur, many silent devotees to this day have kept the invisible current of spiritual meditation flowing. Among many saints who received kriya from Lahiri Mahashai may be mentioned the illustrious Swami Bhaskarananda Saraswati of Benares, and the Dyoga ascetic of high stature, Balananda Brahmachari. For a time, Lahiri Mahashai served as private tutor to the son of Maharaja Ishwari Narayan Sinha Bahadur of Benares. Recognizing the master's spiritual attainment, the Maharaja, as well as his son, sought kriya initiation, as did the Maharaja Jyotindra Mohan Thakur. A number of Lahiri Mahashai's disciples, with influential worldly position, were desirous of expanding the kriya circle by publicity. The guru refused his permission. One chela, the royal physician to the lord of Benares, started an organized effort to spread the master's name as Kashi Baba, exalted one of Benares. Again, the guru forbade it. Let the fragrance of the kriya flower be wafted in a natural way, he said. The seeds of kriya will take sure root in the soil of spiritually fertile hearts. Although the great master did not adopt the system of preaching through the modern medium of an organization or through the printing press, he knew that the power of his message would rise like a resistless flood, inundating by its own force the banks of human minds. The changed and purified lives of devotees were the simple guarantees of the deathless vitality of kriya. In 1886, 25 years after his Raniket initiation, Lahiri Mahashai was retired on a pension. He had given, altogether, 35 years of service in one department of the government. With his availability in the daytime, disciples sought him out in ever-increasing numbers. The great guru now sat in silence most of the time, locked in the tranquil lotus posture. He seldom left his little parlour, even for a walk, or to visit other parts of the house. A quiet stream of chelas arrived, almost ceaselessly, for a darshan, holy sight of the guru. To the awe of all beholders, Lahiri Mahashai's habitual physiological state exhibited the superhuman features of breathlessness, sleeplessness, cessation of pulse and heartbeat, calm eyes unblinking for hours, and a profound aura of peace. No visitors departed without upliftment of spirit. All knew that they had received the silent blessing of a true man of God. The Master now permitted his disciple, Panchanon Bhattacharya, to open in Calcutta a yoga centre, the Arya Mission Institution. The centre distributed certain yogic herbal medicines and published the first inexpensive editions in Bengal of the Bhagavad Gita. The Arya Mission Gita, in Hindi and Bengali, found its way into thousands of homes. In accordance with the ancient custom, the Master gave to people in general a neem oil for the cure of various diseases. When the Guru requested a disciple to distill the oil, he could easily accomplish the task. If anyone else tried, he would encounter strange difficulties, finding, after putting the oil through the required distilling process, that the liquid had almost completely evaporated. Evidently, the Master's blessing was a necessary ingredient. Lahiri Mahashai's handwriting and signature, in Bengali script, are shown here. The lines occur in a letter to a chela. The great master interprets a Sanskrit verse as follows. He who has attained a state of calmness, wherein his eyelids do not blink, has achieved Sambhavi Mudra. Signed, Sri Shyama Charan Deva Sharman. Like many other great prophets, Lahiri Mahashai himself wrote no books, but instructed various disciples in his interpretations of the scriptures. My dear friend, Sri Anandamohan Lahiri, a late grandson of the Master, wrote the following. The Bhagavad Gita and other parts of the Mahabharata epic possess several knot points, vyaskutas. Keep the knot points unquestioned, and we find only mythical stories of a peculiar and easily misunderstood type. Leave the knot points unexplained, and we lose a science that India has preserved with superhuman patience after a quest of thousands of years of experiment. Lahiri Mahashai brought to light, clear of allegories, the science of religion that had been cleverly put out of sight in a riddle of scriptural imagery. No longer an unintelligible jugglery of words, the formulas of Vedic worship had been proved by the Master to be full of scientific significance. We know that man is usually helpless against evil passions, but these are rendered powerless, and man finds no motive for indulging in them when there dawns on him a consciousness of superior and lasting bliss through Kriya Yoga. Here the give-up, the negation of the lower nature, synchronizes with a take-up, the experience of beatitude. Without such a course, moral maxims that embody mere negatives are useless to us. It is the infinite, the ocean of power, that lies behind all phenomenal manifestations. Our eagerness for worldly activity kills in us the sense of spiritual awe. Because modern science tells us how to utilize the powers of nature, we fail to comprehend the great life in back of all names and forms. Familiarity with nature has bred contempt for her ultimate secrets. Our relation with her is one of practical business. We tease her, so to speak, to discover the ways in which she may be forced to serve our purposes. We make use of her energies, whose source yet remains unknown. In science, our relationship with nature is like that between an arrogant man and his servant, or, in a philosophical sense, nature is like a captive in the witness box. We cross-examine her, challenge her, and minutely weigh her evidence in human scales that cannot measure her hidden values. On the other hand, when the self is in communion with a higher power, nature automatically obeys, without stress or strain, the will of man. This effortless command over nature is called miraculous by the uncomprehending materialist. The life of Lahiri Mahashai set an example which changed the erroneous notion that yoga is a mysterious practice. In spite of the matter-of-factness of physical science, every man may find a way through Kriya Yoga to understand his proper relation with nature and to feel spiritual reverence for all phenomena, whether mystical or of everyday occurrence. We should bear in mind that many things, inexplicable 1,000 years ago, are no longer so, and matters mysterious now may become lawfully intelligible a few years hence. The science of Kriya Yoga is eternal. It is true like mathematics, like the simple rules of addition and subtraction. The law of Kriya can never be destroyed. Burn to ashes all books on mathematics. The logically minded will always rediscover such truths. Suppress all books on yoga. Its fundamentals will be re-revealed whenever there appears a sage with pure devotion and, consequently, pure knowledge. Just as Babaji is among the greatest of avatars, a Mahavatar, and as Sri Yukteswar may justly be called a Jnana Avatar, or incarnation of wisdom, so Lahiri Mahashai was a Yogavatar, or incarnation of yoga. By the standards of both qualitative and quantitative good, the great master elevated the spiritual level of society. In his power to raise his close disciples to Christ-like stature, and in his wide dissemination of truth among the masses, Lahiri Mahashai ranks among the saviors of mankind. His uniqueness as a prophet lies in his practical stress on a definite method, Kriya, opening for the first time the doors of yoga freedom to all men. Apart from the miracles of his own life, surely the Yogavatar reached the zenith of all wonders in reducing the ancient complexities of yoga to an effective simplicity within the ordinary grasp. In reference to miracles, Lahiri Mahashai often said, "The operation of subtle laws that are unknown to people in general should not be publicly discussed or published without due discrimination." If in these pages I have appeared to flout his cautionary words, it is because he has given me an inner reassurance. However, in recording the lives of Babaji, Lahiri Mahashai, and Sri Yukteswar, I have thought it advisable to omit certain miraculous stories. I could hardly have included them without writing also an explanatory volume of abstruse philosophy. As a householder yogi, Lahiri Mahashai brought a practical message suited to the needs of today's world. The excellent economic and religious conditions of ancient India no longer obtain. The great master, therefore, did not encourage the old ideal of a yogi as a wandering ascetic with a begging bowl. He stressed rather the advantages to a yogi of earning his own living, of not being dependent on a hard-pressed society for support, and of practicing yoga in the privacy of his home. To this counsel, Lahiri Mahashai added the heartening force of his own example. He was a modern, streamlined model of a yogi. His way of life, as planned by Babaji, was intended to be a guide for aspiring yogis in all parts of the world. New hope for new men. Divine union, the Yogavatar proclaimed, is possible through self-effort and is not dependent on theological beliefs or on the arbitrary will of a cosmic dictator. Through use of the Kriya Key, persons who cannot bring themselves to believe in the divinity of any man will behold at last the full divinity of their own selves. Chapter 36. Babaji's Interest in the West. Master, did you ever meet Babaji? It was a calm summer night in Serampore. The large stars of the tropics gleamed over our heads as I sat by Sri Yukteswar's side on the second-story balcony of the hermitage. Yes, Master smiled at my direct question, his eyes lit with reverence. 3 times I have been blessed by the sight of the deathless Guru. Our first meeting was in Allahabad, at Kumbh Mela. The religious fairs held in India from time immemorial are known as Kumbh Melas. They have kept spiritual goals in constant sight of the multitude. Devout Hindus gather by millions every 12 years to meet thousands of sadhus, yogis, swamis, and ascetics of all kinds. Many are hermits who never leave their secluded haunts except to attend the melas and there bestow blessings on worldly men and women. I was not a swami at the time I met Babaji, Sri Yukteswar went on, but I had already received Kriya initiation from Lahiri Mahashai. He encouraged me to attend the mela that was convening in January 1894 in Allahabad. It was my first experience of a kumbha. I felt slightly dazed by the clamour and surge of the crowd. I gazed around searchingly but saw no illuminated face of a master. Passing a bridge on the bank of the Ganges, I noticed an acquaintance standing nearby, his begging bowl extended. "Oh, this fair is nothing but a chaos of noise and beggars," I thought in disillusionment. "I wonder if Western scientists, patiently enlarging the realms of knowledge for the practical good of mankind, are not more pleasing to God than these idlers who profess religion but concentrate on alms." My smouldering reflections on social reform were interrupted by the voice of a tall sannyasi who halted before me. "Sir," he said, "a saint is calling you." "Who is he?" "Come and see for yourself." Hesitantly following this laconic advice, I soon found myself near a tree whose branches were sheltering a guru with an attractive group of disciples. The master, a bright, unusual figure with sparkling dark eyes, rose at my approach and embraced me. "Welcome, Swamiji," he said affectionately. "Sir," I replied emphatically, "I am not a swami." Those on whom I am divinely directed to bestow the title of swami never cast it off. The saint addressed me simply, but a deep conviction of truth rang in his words. I was instantly engulfed in a wave of spiritual blessing. Smiling at my sudden elevation into the ancient monastic order, I bowed at the feet of the obviously great and angelic being in human form who had thus honoured me. Babaji, for it was indeed he, motioned me to a seat near him under the tree. He was strong and young, and looked like Lahiri Mahashai, yet the resemblance did not strike me, even though I had often heard of the extraordinary similarities in the appearance of the two masters. Babaji possesses a power by which he can prevent any specific thought from arising in a person's mind. Evidently, the great guru wished me to be perfectly natural in his presence, not overawed by knowledge of his identity. "What do you think of the Kumbha Mela?" "I was greatly disappointed, sir," I said, but added hastily, "up until the time I met you. Somehow, saints and this commotion don't seem to belong together." "Child," the master said, though apparently I was nearly twice his own age, "for the faults of the many, judge not the whole. Everything on earth is of mixed character, like a mingling of sand and sugar. Be like the wise ant that seizes only the sugar and leaves the sand untouched. Though many sadhus here still wander in delusion, yet the mela is blessed by a few men of God-realization." In view of my own meeting with this exalted master, I quickly agreed with him. "Sir," I commented, "I have been thinking of the leading scientific men of the West. Greater by far in intelligence than most people congregated here, living in distant Europe and America, professing different creeds, and ignorant of the real values of such melas as the present one. They are the men who could benefit greatly by meetings with India's masters, but, although high in intellectual attainments, many Westerners are wedded to rank materialism. Others, famous in science and philosophy, do not recognize the essential unity in religion. Their creeds serve as insurmountable barriers that threaten to separate them from us forever." "I saw that you are interested in the West, as well as in the East." Babaji's face beamed with approval. "I felt the pangs of your heart, broad enough for all men. That is why I summoned you here. East and West must establish a golden middle path of activity and spirituality combined," he continued. "India has much to learn from the West in material development. In return, India can teach the universal methods by which the West will be able to base its religious beliefs on the unshakable foundations of yogic science. You, Swamiji, have a part to play in the coming harmonious exchange between Orient and Occident. Some years hence, I shall send you a disciple whom you can train for yoga dissemination in the West. The vibrations there of many spiritually seeking souls come flood-like to me. I perceive potential saints in America and Europe waiting to be awakened. At this point in his story, Sri Yukteswar turned his gaze fully on mine. "My son," he said, smiling in the bright moonlight, "you are the disciple that years ago Babaji promised to send me." I was happy to learn that Babaji had directed my steps to Sri Yukteswar, yet it was hard for me to visualize myself in the remote West, away from my beloved guru and the simple hermitage peace. Babaji then spoke of the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Yukteswar went on. To my astonishment, he indicated by a few words of praise that he knew I had written interpretations of several Gita chapters. "At my request, Swamiji, please undertake another task," the great master said. "Will you not write a short book on the underlying harmony between Christian and Hindu scriptures? Their basic unity is now obscured by men's sectarian differences. Show by parallel references that the inspired sons of God have spoken the same truths." "Maharaj," I answered diffidently, "what a command! Shall I be able to fulfill it?" Babaji laughed softly. "My son, why do you doubt?" he said reassuringly. "Indeed, whose work is all this? And who is the doer of all actions? Whatever the Lord has made me say is bound to materialize as truth." I deemed myself empowered by the blessings of the saint, and agreed to write the book. Feeling that the parting hour had arrived, I rose reluctantly from my leafy seat. "Do you know Lahiri?" the master inquired. "He's a great soul, isn't he? Tell him of our meeting." He then gave me a message for Lahiri Mahashai. After I had bowed humbly in farewell, the saint smiled benignly. "When your book is finished, I shall pay you a visit," he promised. "Goodbye for the present." I left Allahabad the following day and entrained for Benares. Reaching my guru's home, I poured out the story of the wonderful saint at the Kumbh Mela. "Oh, didn't you recognize him?" Lahiri Mahashai's eyes were dancing with laughter. "I see you couldn't, for he prevented you. He's my incomparable guru, the celestial Babaji." "Babaji," I repeated awestruck, "the yogi Christ Babaji, the invisible, visible saviour Babaji. Oh, if I could just recall the past and be once more in his presence to show my devotion at his lotus feet." "Never mind," Lahiri Mahashai said consolingly. "He has promised to see you again." "Gurudeva, the divine master, asked me to give you a message." "Tell Lahiri," he said, "that the stored-up power for this life now runs low. It is nearly finished." At my utterance of these enigmatic words, Lahiri Mahashai's figure trembled, as though touched by a lightning current. In an instant, everything about him fell silent. His smiling countenance turned incredibly stern. Like a wooden statue, somber and immovable in its seat, his body became colourless. I was alarmed and bewildered. Never in my life had I seen this joyous soul manifest such awful gravity. The other disciples present stared apprehensively. 3 hours passed in silence. Then Lahiri Mahashai resumed his natural cheerful demeanour and spoke affectionately to each of the chelas. Everyone sighed in relief. I realized, by my master's reaction, that Babaji's message had been an unmistakable signal by which Lahiri Mahashai understood that his body would soon be untenanted. His awesome silence proved that my guru had instantly controlled his being, cut the last cord of attachment to the material world, and fled to his ever-living identity in spirit. Babaji's remark had been his way of saying, I shall be ever with you. Though Babaji and Lahiri Mahashai were omniscient and had no need of communicating with each other through me or any other intermediary, the great ones often condescend to play a part in the human drama. Occasionally, they transmit their prophecies through messengers in an ordinary way, that later the fulfillment of their words infuse greater divine faith in a wide circle of men who learn the story. I soon left Banaras and set to work in Serampore on the scriptural writings requested by Babaji. Sri Yukteswar continued, no sooner had I begun my task than I was inspired to compose a poem dedicated to the deathless Guru. The melodious lines flowed effortlessly from my pen, though never before had I attempted Sanskrit poetry. In the quiet of night, I busied myself over a comparison of the Bible and the scriptures of Sanatan Dharma. Quoting the words of the blessed Lord Jesus, I showed that his teachings are in essence one with the revelations of the Vedas. Through the grace of my Param Guru, my book, The Holy Science, was finished in a short time. The morning after I had concluded my literary efforts, Master continued, I went to the Rai Ghat here to bathe in the Ganges. The Ghat was deserted. I stood still for a while, enjoying the sunny peace. After a dip in the sparkling waters, I started for home. The only sound in the silence was that of my Ganges-drenched cloth, swish-swashing with every step. As I passed beyond the sight of the large banyan tree near the riverbank, a strong impulse urged me to look back. There, under the shade of the banyan, and surrounded by a few disciples, sat the great Babaji. "Greetings, Swamiji," the beautiful voice of the Master rang out to assure me I was not dreaming. "I see you have successfully completed your book. As I promised, I am here to thank you." With a fast-beating heart, I prostrated myself fully at his feet. "Param Guruji," I said imploringly, "will you and your chelas not honour my nearby home with your presence?" The Supreme Guru smilingly declined. "No, child," he said. "We are people who like the shelter of trees. This spot is quite comfortable." "Please tarry a while, Master," I gazed entreatingly at him. "I shall be back at once with some special sweetmeats." When I returned in a few minutes with a dish of delicacies, the lordly banyan no longer sheltered the celestial troop. I searched all around the Ghat, but in my heart I knew that the little band had already fled on etheric wings. I was deeply hurt. "Even if we meet again, I would not care to talk with Babaji," I told myself. He was unkind to leave me so suddenly. This was a wrath of love, of course, and nothing more. A few months later, I visited Lahiri Mahashai in Banaras. As I entered his parlour, my guru smiled in greeting. "Welcome, Yukteswar," he said. "Did you just meet Babaji at the threshold of my room?" "Why, no," I answered in surprise. "Come here." Lahiri Mahashai touched me gently on the forehead. At once I beheld, near the door, the form of Babaji, blooming like a perfect lotus. I remembered my old hurt and did not bow. Lahiri Mahashai looked at me in astonishment. The divine guru was gazing at me with fathomless eyes. "You are annoyed with me." "So why shouldn't I be?" I answered. "Out of the air you came with your magic group, and into the thin air you vanished." "I told you I would see you, but I didn't say how long I would remain," Babaji laughed softly. "You were full of excitement. I assure you that I was fairly extinguished in the ether by the gust of your restlessness." I was instantly satisfied by this unflattering explanation. I knelt at his feet. The Supreme Guru patted me kindly on the shoulder. "Child, you must meditate more," he said. "Your gaze is not yet faultless. You could not see me hiding behind the sunlight." With these words, in a voice like a celestial flute, Babaji disappeared into the hidden radiance. That was one of my last visits to Banaras to see my guru, Sri Yukteswar concluded. Even as Babaji had foretold, at the Kumbh Mela, the householder incarnation of Lahiri Mahashai was drawing to a close. During the summer of 1895, his stalwart body developed a small boil on the back. He protested against lancing. He was working out in his own flesh the evil karma of some of his disciples. Finally, a few chelas became very insistent. The master replied cryptically, "The body has to find a cause to go. I will be agreeable to whatever you want to do." A short time later, the incomparable guru gave up his body in Banaras. "No longer need I seek him out in his little parlour. I find every day of my life blessed by his omnipresent guidance." Years later, from the lips of Swami Keshavananda, an advanced disciple, I heard many wonderful details about the passing of Lahiri Mahashai. A few days before my guru relinquished his body, Keshavananda told me, he materialized himself before me as I sat in my hermitage at Hardwar. "Come at once to Banaras." With these words, Lahiri Mahashai vanished. I entrained immediately for Banaras. At my guru's home, I found many disciples assembled. For hours that day, the master expounded the Gita. Then he addressed us simply, "I am going home." Our sobs of anguish broke out like an irresistible torrent. "Be comforted, I shall rise again." After this utterance, Lahiri Mahashai rose from his seat, thrice turned his body round in a circle, assumed the lotus posture while facing the north, and gloriously entered Mahasamadhi. Lahiri Mahashai's beautiful body, so dear to the devotees, was cremated with solemn householder rites at Manikarnika Ghat by the holy Ganges. Keshavananda continued the following day at 10 o'clock in the morning, while I was still in Banaras, my room was suffused with a great light. Lo, before me stood the flesh and blood form of Lahiri Mahashai. It looked exactly like his old body, except that it appeared younger and more radiant. My divine guru spoke to me. "Keshavananda," he said, "it is I. From the disintegrated atoms of my cremated body, I have resurrected a remodeled form. My householder work in this world is done, but I do not leave the earth entirely. Henceforth, I shall spend some time with Babaji in the Himalayas and with Babaji in the cosmos." With a few words of blessing to me, the transcendent master vanished. Wondrous inspiration filled my heart. I was uplifted in spirit, even as were the disciples of Christ and Kabir, who beheld their living guru after his physical death. When I returned to my isolated hermitage in Hardwar, Keshavananda went on, I carried with me a portion of the sacred ashes of Lahiri Mahashai. I knew he had escaped the spatio-temporal cage. The bird of omnipresence was freed. Yet it comforted my heart to enshrine his holy ashes. Another disciple who was blessed by the sight of his resurrected guru was the saintly Panchanan Bhattacharya. I visited him in his home in Calcutta and listened with delight to the story of his many years with the master. In conclusion, he told me of the most marvellous event in his life. "Here, in Calcutta," Panchanan said, "at 10 o'clock of the morning that followed his cremation, Lahiri Mahashai appeared before me in living glory. Swami Pranabananda, the saint with two bodies, also confided to me the details of his own supernal experience. During his visit to my Ranchi school, Pranabananda told me, a few days before Lahiri Mahashai left his body, I received from him a letter that requested me to come at once to Banaras. I was unavoidably delayed, however, and could not leave at once. Just as I was preparing to leave for Banaras about 10 o'clock in the morning, I was suddenly overwhelmed with joy to see in my room the shining figure of my guru. "Why hurry to Benares?" the Hari Mahashaya said, smiling. "You shall find me there no longer." As the import of his words dawned on me, I cried out brokenheartedly, believing that I was seeing him only in a vision. The Master approached me comfortingly. "Here, touch my flesh," he said. "I am living as always. Do not lament. Am I not with you forever?" From the lips of these three great disciples, a story of wondrous truth has emerged. At the morning hour of 10, one day after the body of Lahiri Mahasha had been consigned to the flames, the resurrected Master, in a real but transfigured body, appeared before three disciples, each in a different city. "So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?" Chapter 37. I Go to America. America! Surely these people are Americans. This was my thought as a panorama of Western faces passed before my inward view. Immersed in meditation, I was sitting behind some dusty boxes in the storeroom of the Ranchi school. A private spot was difficult to find during those busy years with the youngsters. The vision continued, a vast multitude gazing at me intently, swept actor-like across the stage of consciousness. The storeroom door opened. As usual, one of the young lads had discovered my hiding place. "Come here, Bimal," I cried gaily. "I have news for you. The Lord is calling me to America." "To America?" The boy echoed my words in a tone that implied I had said to the moon. "Yes, I am going forth to discover America like Columbus. He thought he had found India. Surely there is a karmic link between these two lands." Bimal scampered away. Soon the whole school was informed by the two-legged newspaper. I summoned the bewildered faculty and gave the school into its charge. "I know you'll keep Lahiri Mahashaya's yoga ideals of education ever to the fore," I said. "I shall write you frequently. God willing, some day I shall be back." Tears stood in my eyes as I cast a last look at the little boys and the sunny acres of Ranchi. A definite epoch in my life had now closed, I knew. Henceforth, I would dwell in far lands. I entrained for Calcutta a few hours after my vision. The following day, I received an invitation to serve as the delegate from India to an international congress of religious liberals in America. It was to convene that year in Boston, under the auspices of the American Unitarian Association. My head in a whirl, I sought out Sri Yukteswar in Serampore. "Guruji, I have just been invited to address a religious congress in America. Shall I go?" "All doors are open for you," Master replied simply. "It is now or never." "But, sir," I said in dismay, "what do I know about public speaking? Seldom have I given a lecture, and never in English." "English or no English, your words on yoga shall be heard in the West." I laughed. "Well, dear Guruji, I hardly think the Americans will learn Bengali. Please, bless me with a push over the hurdles of the English language." When I broke the news of my plans to Father, he was utterly taken aback. To him, America seemed incredibly remote. He feared he might never see me again. "How can you go?" he asked sternly. "Who will finance you?" As he had affectionately borne the expenses of my education and whole life, he doubtless hoped that his question would bring my project to an embarrassing halt. "The Lord will surely finance me." As I made this reply, I thought of the similar one I had given long ago to my brother Ananta in Agra. without very much guile, I added, Father, perhaps God will put it into your mind to help me. No, never. He glanced at me piteously. I was astounded, therefore, when Father handed me the following day a check made out for a large amount. I give you this money, he said, not in my role as a father, but as a faithful disciple of Lahiri Mahashai. Go then to that far western land. Spread there the creedless teachings of Kriya Yoga. I was immensely touched at the selfless spirit in which Father had been able quickly to put aside his personal desires. The just realization had come to him during the preceding night that no ordinary desire for foreign travel was motivating my plans. Perhaps we shall not meet again in this life. Father, who was 67 at this time, spoke sadly. An intuitive conviction prompted me to reply, Surely the Lord will bring us together once more. As I went about my preparations to leave Master and my native land for the unknown shores of America, I experienced not a little trepidation. I had heard many stories about the materialistic West, a land very different from India, steeped in the centuried aura of saints. To dare the Western airs, I thought, an Oriental teacher should be hardy beyond the trials of any Himalayan cold. One early morning, I began to pray, with an adamant determination to continue, even to die, praying, until I heard the voice of God. I wanted his blessing and assurance that I would not lose myself in the fogs of modern utilitarianism. My heart was set to go to America, but even more strongly it was resolved to hear the solace of divine permission. I prayed and prayed, muffling my sobs. No answer came. At noon, I reached a zenith. My head was reeling under the pressure of my agonies. I felt that if I cried once more, increasing the depth of my inner passion, my brain would split. At that moment, there came a knock on the door of my Garpa Road home. Answering the summons, I beheld a young man in the scanty garb of a renunciant. He entered the house. He must be Babaji, I thought, dazed, because the man before me had the features of a young Lahiri Mahashai. He answered my thought. Yes, I am Babaji. He spoke melodiously in Hindi. Our Heavenly Father has heard your prayer. He commands me to tell you, follow the behests of your guru and go to America. Fear not. You shall be protected. After a vibrant pause, Babaji addressed me again. You are the one I have chosen to spread the message of Kriya Yoga in the West. Long ago, I met your guru, Yukteswar, at a Kumbh Mela. I told him then I would send you to him for training. I was speechless, choked with devotional awe at his presence, and deeply touched to hear from his own lips that he had guided me to Sri Yukteswar. I lay prostrate before the deathless guru. He graciously lifted me up. After telling me many things about my life, he gave me some personal instruction and uttered a few secret prophecies. Kriya Yoga, the scientific technique of God-realization, he finally said with solemnity, will ultimately spread in all lands and aid in harmonizing the nations through man's personal, transcendental perception of the Infinite Father. With a gaze of majestic power, the Master electrified me with a glimpse of his cosmic consciousness. If there should rise suddenly within the skies sunburst of a thousand suns, flooding earth with beams undeemed of, then might be that Holy One's majesty and radiance dreamed of. In a short while, Babaji started toward the door, remarking, Do not try to follow me. You will not be able to do so. Please, Babaji, don't go away, I cried repeatedly. Take me with you. He replied, Not now. Some other time. Overcome by emotion, I disregarded his warning. As I tried to pursue him, I discovered that my feet were firmly rooted to the floor. From the door, Babaji gave me a last affectionate glance. My eyes were fixed on him longingly as he raised his hand by way of benediction and walked away. After a few minutes, my feet were free. I sat down and went into a deep meditation, unceasingly thanking God not only for answering my prayer, but for blessing me by a meeting with Babaji. My whole body seemed sanctified through the touch of the ancient, ever-youthful master. Long had it been my burning desire to behold him. Until now, I have never recounted to anyone this story of my meeting with Babaji. Holding it as the most sacred of my human experiences, I have hidden it in my heart. But the thought occurred to me that readers of this autobiography would be more inclined to believe in the reality of the secluded Babaji with his world interests if I relate that I have seen him with my own eyes. I have helped an artist to draw for this book a true picture of the Yogi Christ of modern India. The eve of my departure for the United States found me in Sri Yukteswar's holy presence. Forget you were born among Hindus, and don't adopt all the ways of the Americans. Take the best of both peoples, he said in his calm way of wisdom. Be your true self, a child of God. Seek and incorporate into your being the best qualities of all your brothers, scattered over the earth in various races. Then he blessed me. All those who come to you with faith, seeking God, will be helped. As you look at them, the spiritual current emanating from your eyes will enter their brains and change their material habits, making them more God-conscious. Smilingly, he added, your lot to attract sincere souls is very good. Everywhere you go, even in a wilderness, you will find friends. Both of Sri Yukteswar's blessings have been amply demonstrated. I came alone to America, in which I had not a single friend, but there I found thousands ready to receive the timeless soul teachings. I left India in August 1920 on the City of Sparta, the first passenger boat sailing for America after the close of the World War. I had been able to book passage only after the removal, in ways fairly miraculous, of many red tape difficulties concerned with the granting of my passport. During the 2-month voyage, a fellow passenger found out that I was the Indian delegate to the Boston Congress. Swami Yogananda, he said, with the first of many quaint pronunciations by which I was later to hear my name spoken by the Americans. Please favour the passengers with a lecture next Thursday night. I think we would all benefit by a talk on the battle of life and how to fight it. Alas, I had to fight the battle of my own life, I discovered on Wednesday. Desperately trying to organize my ideas into a lecture in English, I finally abandoned all preparations. My thoughts, like a wild colt eyeing a saddle, refused any cooperation with the rules of English grammar. Fully trusting in Master's past assurances, however, I appeared before my Thursday audience in the saloon of the steamer. No eloquence rose to my lips. Speechlessly, I stood before the assemblage. After an endurance contest lasting 10 minutes, the audience realized my predicament and began to laugh. The situation was not funny to me at the moment. Indignantly, I sent a silent prayer to Master. You can. Speak. His voice sounded instantly within my consciousness. My thoughts fell at once into a friendly relation with the English language. 45 minutes later, the audience was still attentive. The talk won me a number of invitations to lecture later before various groups in America. I never could remember afterward a word that I had spoken. By discreet inquiry, I learned from a number of passengers you gave an inspiring lecture in stirring and correct English. At this delightful news, I humbly thanked my guru for his timely help, realizing anew that he was ever with me, setting at naught all barriers of time and space. Once in a while, during the remainder of the ocean trip, I experienced a few apprehensive twinges about the coming English lecture ordeal at the Boston Congress. Lord, I prayed deeply, please let my sole inspiration be thyself. The city of Sparta docked near Boston in late September. On October the 6th, 1920, I addressed the Congress with my maiden speech in America. It was well received. I sighed in relief. The magnanimous secretary of the American Unitarian Association wrote the following comment in a published account of the Congress proceedings. Swami Yogananda, delegate from the Brahmacharya Ashram of Ranchi, brought the greetings of his association to the Congress. In fluent English, and with a forceful delivery, he gave an address of a philosophical character on the science of religion, which has been printed in pamphlet form for a wider distribution. Religion, he maintained, is universal, and it is one. We cannot possibly universalize particular customs and conventions, but the common element in religion can be universalized, and we may ask all alike to follow and obey it. Because of Father's generous check, I was able to remain in America after the Congress was over. 3 happy years were spent in humble circumstances in Boston. I gave public lectures, taught classes, and wrote a book of poems, Songs of the Soul, with a preface by Dr. Frederick B. Robinson, president of the College of the City of New York. Starting a transcontinental tour in 1924, I spoke before thousands in many of the principal cities. In Seattle, I embarked for a vacation in beautiful Alaska. With the help of large-hearted students, by the end of 1925, I had established an American headquarters on Mount Washington Estates in Los Angeles. The building is the one I had seen years before in my vision at Kashmir. I hastened to send Sri Yukteswar pictures of these distant American activities. He replied with a postcard in Bengali, which I here translate. 11th August, 1926. Child of my heart, O Yogananda, seeing the photos of your school and students, what joy comes in my life I cannot express in words. I am melting in joy to see your yoga students of different cities, hearing about your methods of chant affirmations, healing vibrations, and divine healing prayers. I cannot refrain from thanking you from my heart. Seeing the gate, the winding hilly way upward, and the beautiful scenery spread out beneath Mount Washington Estates, I yearn to behold it all with my own eyes. Everything here is going on well. Through the grace of God, may you ever be in bliss. Sri Yukteswar Giri. Years sped by. I lectured in every part of my new land and addressed hundreds of clubs, colleges, churches, and groups of every denomination. During the decade of 1920 to 1930, my yoga classes were attended by tens of thousands of Americans. To them all, I dedicated a new book of prayers and soul thoughts, Whispers from Eternity, published by Self-Realization Fellowship with a preface by Madame Amelita Galli-Cursi. Sometimes, usually on the first of the month, when bills rolled in for the upkeep of Mount Washington Center, headquarters of Self-Realization Fellowship, I thought longingly of the simple peace of India. But daily I saw a widening understanding between West and East. My soul rejoiced. George Washington, the father of his country, who felt on many occasions that he was being divinely guided, uttered in his farewell address the following words of spiritual inspiration for America. It will be worthy of a free, an enlightened, and at no distant period a great nation, to give to mankind the magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence. Who can doubt that, in the course of time and things, the fruits of such a plan would richly repay any temporary advantages which might be lost by a steady adherence to it? Can it be that Providence has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue? Walt Whitman's Hymn to America from Thou Mother with Thy Equal Brood. Thee in thy future, thee in thy larger, saner brood of female, male, thee in thy athletes, moral, spiritual, south, north, west, east, thee in thy moral wealth and civilization, until which thy proudest material civilization must remain in vain, thee in thy all-supplying, all-enclosing worship, thee in no single Bible, Saviour merely, thy Saviours countless, latent within thyself, equal to any, divine as any, these in thee, certain to come, today I prophesy.